Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. Gold miners had their best week in 5 months. Ross takes a look at crude, bonds, and the U.S. and Canadian dollars. Publisher of the trendletter.com, Martin Straith, examines recent moves with the Dow, the possibility of recession, and tells us why crude might be on the move up next year due to little government support for new oil discoveries. WolfStreet.com publisher Wolf Richter checks in from San Francisco to chat about inflation, housing bubbles, crypto crashing, and the used and new vehicle markets. Plus, at the end of the show, we'll have a company showcase update from Recyclico CEO Zarko Maselgia. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Introducing Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB, AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on Twitter at chartsbyross. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Good to be with you, Jim.
What kind of week did we have on the stock markets?
Well, not a lot of volume this week, seeing as they had a Thanksgiving holiday on Thursday. But overall, equities up about 1.5% to 2%, depending upon the index you're looking at. The one that's sort of the laggard in this is the NASDAQ, the NDX. All those big named tech stocks still having a tough time coming back. But, the rest of the indices, you look at the Dow making nice new highs we haven't seen since the summer. Actually, you've got to go all the way back above those summer highs back to May to look at where the Dow's coming from. So pretty much a leader as far as that's concerned. And we are in the seasonal window. You would expect that there would be some type of a correction between here and mid-December. And historically, any oversold condition that happens as you get into that second or third week of December becomes a great secondary buying opportunity on that kind of a pullback. So that's the type of thing you'd look for. And historically, Santa Claus comes around and you get that year-end bump that can take you into the first week or two of January.
What's happening with the bond market?
Well, you know, everybody's talking about these rising interest rates and how high they are. But, you know, in reality, if we take a look at what's been going on, the bond market bottomed out and the yields topped out the bet part of 3 weeks ago. We've got short rates have gone from 4.25% down to 3.80. The longer bond, when you go out to a 10 or a 30 year, they've dropped from, we got 4.42 on the long bond, which is the high in terms of the yield. That's down to 3.75 right now. So, yes, we are up significantly on rates in the last 3 to 6 months, but they became extreme, and we got lots of good signals in terms of the bond market. Took a while to make the turn, a little bit longer than I thought it would, but once the reversal was in place, getting a nice stair-step to move up in the bonds. The first part of that became a little overbought a week and a half ago, small pullback, and now starting to see the best level in roughly 6 weeks or so now. So still looking for a continuation there. We've got some upper targets, some longer-term moving averages that we have published that we'll be looking for.
Is there some positive news on the gold front?
Gold had what we call a sequential 9-sell setup a week and a half ago. That's 9 consecutive closes about 4 days earlier. And typically from there, you'll get anywhere from a 1 to a 5-day correction. and in this case it was 3.5 days, pulled back to test the support that it had broken out from, and we ended up with a test of the 50-day or the 20-day moving average on both gold and silver on that pullback. They've shown a little bit of strength at the tail end of the week, but the stocks, if we look at the GDX or the GDXJ, which are the junior miners, they ended up closing at the best level we've seen in 5 months. So we've got a longer-term bullish outlook as far as precious metals are concerned, and with this pullback, starting to feel a little more at ease with things. So we know where the support is. It was on this week's pullback, and that's probably a level that we'll use as a bit of a catalyst point or significant point of support that we'll need to hold.
What's going on with crude?
Crude was stuck in just a pretty good trading range for the last month and a half here, and we had looked at the 76.25 as being a key support level, and it bounced off of that at the beginning of the week, but by the tail end of the week, it's right back down at that same support area. From a technical perspective, if we have definitive close here below that support area, then the measurement, if we take a look at the height of the recent consolidation, from roughly 90 down to this 76.25, if we do the precise measurement, the height of that would suggest that we could trade down to $60 as a key support level. So, boxed in right now, and we'll see which way it goes. The movement seems to be right now pressure, at least in the short term.
What's going on with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
U.S. dollar bounced nicely from the 106 up to 108. We had seen sort of 109 to as being a key area of resistance. Couldn't quite make it to that, and it's closed off the week right back down around the supporting area. Still looking at this, call it 105 to 106, as a good support area. It's where the long-term averages are. It's the 38% correction being a Fibonacci level when we take a look at the two-year rally. And so I think it's still ready to just play around in here between 105 and probably, retest the 108 level, 109. And the Canadian dollar did reasonably well considering what was going on with the U.S. up until about a week ago, as it got up, hit its 20-week moving average, which was pretty good resistance. It was also at 75.5, testing the lows that we had seen in the summer. We'd been down to that 75.5. Bounced in July, got there again in September, and had a decent bounce. So we know that that is now a reasonable resistance level, and I guess it's going to take its indications from what happens as firm as the oil market start hurt. If we do start moving towards that $60 oil number, you're probably looking at the Canadian dollar back down around 73.
Ross, thank you so much for the update.
Pleasure to be with you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. You can find him on Twitter at chartsbyross. Coming up, Martin Straith, next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Martin Straith, founder of Trend News Online at thetrendletter.com. He's speaking to us from Coquitlam, British Columbia, which is just down the road from Vancouver. Martin, welcome back to This Week in Money.
Well, thank you, Jim. It's always good to be here.
Before we get into the interview, can you tell us a bit about the Trend Letter, the letters you publish, and how people can sign up?
Oh, absolutely. Well, we have three investment services. The first one is the Trend Letter. Started that back in 2002, so we're in our 21st year. So that publishes every Sunday evening, and it covers equities, currencies, precious metals, commodities, and bonds. Basically, it's about 50 pages, mostly of charts, and then we give you key bullet points to make it very easy to understand. Now, the audience focus for here would be longer-term investors, those people who want to get a better understanding of what drives these markets. Our second service is Trend Technical Trader. Now, that's an online service that started as a hedging service, which has been pretty timely given the markets over the last year here. It also now covers many sectors, including commodities, equities, precious metals, etc. Audience there would be the more active investors. But again, you know, any long-term investor has also been able to benefit, especially with those hedging strategies. And our third service is Trend Disruptors. Now, that's a monthly publication that invests in disruptive ideas. You know, we're talking about artificial intelligence, virtual reality, augmented reality, 5G, cloud, Internet of Things, all that cool stuff. Very speculative, obviously, but we've got a nice watch list that we've grown. It's about 30 companies, and we're just waiting for this market to settle down and put a bottom in, and then we'll be sending out lots of buy alerts to our subscribers there. Audience there, people wishing to obviously speculate, but again, with risk capital that they could afford to lose. And to subscribe, just go to thetrendletter.com, so all one word. And you can email any questions, info@thetrendletter.com.
Has the Dow surprised to the upside, and what do you see ahead for the Dow?
No, not really. You know, we think that the recent moves, we called for a bottom back in late September. So it's moving actually just as we thought it would. Now, the Dow's outperformed the other indexes primarily because it's drawing in foreign capital that wants to move into the U.S. markets. And we're talking about institutional investors here, and they prefer to invest in those blue chip stocks. So that's kind of why you're seeing a lot of action in the Dow perform better than the other indexes. Another reason is that we're in the strongest seasonal period right now, and this is where we often see a Santa Claus rally at year end. So those are all contributors. But I think the last time I was on, Jim, we talked about how bear markets have four stages or phases. And the first one, just as a reminder, that's a stealth phase. So that's where the smart money gets in. Then you have the awareness stage, and that's where the large speculators arrive. And then finally, you get that mania phase, and that's where you get the general public, the retail investors. We like to call it the masses. That's when they jump in. But after that mania phase, we get the blow-off phase, and that's where the market starts to decline. And a couple of key characteristics of that blow-off phase are that we get capitulation and finally get a fair at the bottom, which we've not seen that yet. So that tells us that any rally here would be another short-term relief rally. We have to remember that back in 2002, the NASDAQ had 8 significant rallies within that 2-year bear market. All of those rallies were over 16%, and some of them were over 40%. But still, over that period of time, the NASDAQ lost 75% of its rally. So today we've got the Dow was up 150 points, so it had a nice little day today. Just broke through key resistance here at the August high. So, you know, so far so good. We may get that Santa Claus rally. One thing to note though, technically the Dow is getting overbought here. So I could see the Dow pulling back soon.
Could crude be in a bear market now?
Well, short term, oil's been in a downtrend channel since that June high of about $130. It fell below $80 this week, partly due to the EU negotiating that Russian cap on oil prices. you know, they're targeting $65 to $70. But I think a more impactful is the demand in China that has dropped due to all the lockdowns. You know, right now there are over 400 million people in China affected by these COVID restrictions. You know, that's equal to 10 times Canada's population basically being locked down. You know, according to Associated Press, 20% of China's GDP is now under lockdown. So as a result, Chinese demand for oil has dropped. Chinese imports of oil are down almost 7%. In the U.S., you've got the threat of a national railway strike, and that's going to be another big hit on the oil demand. So we had an original target of oil to test the September low of $76. Today, or Friday, it closed at $76.28, so pretty close to that target. But also near term, you know, we're seeing some recessionary pressure. I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about that a little later. And that's going to push oil down, and we suspect it will go down below the $70 level. Now, long term, we see much higher prices in the next year to 18 months. We see demand will be picking up. On the supply side, you know, we're seeing governments, you know, imposing windfall taxes, tight restrictions, no new drilling permits. And these are all major disincentives for producers to invest in exploration of new sources. So, you know, hence we get lower supply for the longer term. So long term, we see oil up into that maybe $150, even $200 level over the next 12 to 18 months. Now, for investing in oil stocks, one thing your listeners should be aware of is that we're coming up to tax loss season. And this is where we expect that investors who have big losses in other sectors, like the tech sector, that they want to offset those with gains from the energy stocks. So we're expecting that we're going to see some of these stocks selling off. And if we do, we're going to be firing out a bunch of buy alerts to our subscribers over the next couple of weeks.
Does it look like gold has put in a triple bottom since September?
Yeah, so far that 1630 level has held three different times. So, yeah, late September, tested again in mid-October, and also tested again early this month. You know, in late September and October, both our trend letter and technical trader models triggered buy signals near the test of those lows. So that was a nice little rally to catch there. The U.S. dollar has been a major factor in gold movement. So strength in the dollar has kept gold in a downtrend channel from the March high until it broke out of that channel earlier this month. Now, the recent weakness in the U.S. dollar is obviously giving gold a nice spike this month. So going forward, that 1630 remains a key support to us. Near-term resistance is sitting at the recent high at 1775, and then we'd be looking for 1815. You know, gold closed Friday at 1765, so about 10 bucks below our target high there. If we see U.S. dollar strength, then likely we're going to see gold decline near-term. But going forward, as a recession kicks in, I think people are going to start to really continue to lose confidence in the government's ability to manage this economy. And as that confidence continues to decline, we're going to see gold really start to rise.
Does it look like silver has put in a head and shoulders bottom?
Yeah, it certainly could be. As you know, gold and silver generally move together, and silver being the more volatile of the two. So, you know, silver tends to rise faster in a bear market than gold does, but then on the other side of it, it declines faster in a bear market. Now, silver's up a little bit today, closed at $21.37. $21 is our near-term support. One of the things we really like is that both gold and silver appear to have formed a nice base over the last few months. So, you know, if that base can hold, we think that we're going to have a good run here in a little bit. So key support for silver would be $18. Longer term, like I say, we see a significant rally for both gold and silver.
What are your thoughts on the U.S. dollar?
Well, we've been bullish the U.S. dollar since January 21. So, you know, that's almost 2 years. And we played it by actually using a leveraged short on the euro, and it's done extremely well. Now, at the end of September, I mean, the U.S. dollar was extremely overbought, and we warned our subscribers that a pullback down to the 110 and even likely the 105 level was, you know, very possible. Now, the U.S. dollar is currently trading at 106. So again, pretty close to that target support level. You know, the Fed rate hikes have fueled that long rally in the U.S. dollar. Now we've got all these hopes that the Fed's going to pause or even pivot, and that's contributed to the U.S. dollar decline. Another factor is these other central banks, like the Bank of China, we got the ECB, the Bank of Japan. You know, they've all been recently selling the U.S. dollar, trying to boost their local currencies. But, you know, reality is we think that this sell-off is overdone in the U.S. dollar, so we're expecting it to start to turn up again soon. Now, currency moves can certainly run longer than seems logical at times, but again, we're kind of looking for this to turn around a bit. The high has been 114, so that remains near-term resistance. Longer term, we see the U.S. dollar trading up to that 120 level. Interesting development last week, Jim. The U.S. is starting up a 12-week pilot project for a digital dollar, and they're looking to do that at the end of the first quarter. Now, many countries are doing this. Certainly China's been heavily into it, and Canada's looking at it as well. Because ultimately, these governments want to eliminate cash. Because if they can eliminate cash, that creates the potential for them to track and even control consumer spending. And once they are, once we're all using that digital currency, then they're going to be able to tax or apply fees to every transaction we make. I mean, even a parent giving the child allowance is likely going to be subject to some sort of tax and fees. So there's something to look forward to, Jim.
Could the Canadian dollar be in a new bull market?
Yeah, well, the loonie's had a nice run this last month, up from about 72 cents, which was a kind of a key support level, up to, you know, 7.55. Today it closed at 74.8, so, you know, it's still hanging in there. But any movement of the Canadian dollar really up or down is really driven by the U.S. dollar. You know, when the U.S. dollar is strong, the Canadian dollar is weak and vice versa. So recent weakness in the U.S. dollar has certainly boosted the Canadian and most other currencies. So 72 cents is still the near-term support level. 76 is our near-term resistance. I think that when we get the next leg up in commodities, we're going to see a really nice run for the Canadian dollar. But before that, I think we're going to get a recession, and then there's going to be another leg down, and you know, leg down in commodities would push the Canadian dollar down. You know, the Canadian dollar is also very tightly correlated to the S&P 500. You know, they tend to move in tandem. So, you know, if we do see a recession, we see the markets go down, we'll probably see commodities go down, and the Canadian dollar would go down. Big picture, again, it's really the U.S. dollar that drives most currency moves.
What do you see ahead for the euro and the yen?
Well, I mean, really the same story. Again, it's really the U.S. dollar. You know, U.S. dollar strength, other currencies, you know, the other way around. Now, both the euro and the yen were in steep downtrend channels from about February to October. Those October lows were quite historic. I mean, the Japanese yen had fallen 33% from the high down to that October low. I mean, and that was I think it was a 32-year low. The euro then had a 2-year decline, and it actually fell below par to the U.S. dollar when it hit that October low. Now, as noted earlier, the Bank of Japan, the ECB, Bank of China, they've all been intervening in the currency markets, and they've, you know, been trying to boost up their local currencies, and it's been working short term at least. And again, ultimately, all of these currencies are going to be based on how strong is the U.S. dollar, and that's going to drive everything, you know, higher or lower.
If you were to keep cash in a currency to preserve wealth, which currency would be your top pick?
Well, again, I mean, I know there's a lot of talk about, you know, the euro and the yen and the U.S. dollar's dead. But, you know, the U.S. dollar is still the least ugly house on the block. You know, when the U.S. dollar's been in, well, it's been in a downtrend over the last couple months, we still see it as being the strongest currency going forward. You know, I mean, the long-term alternatives are very limited. You know, if you look at the euro, I mean, the ECB has destroyed the European bond system with their negative rates that they started in 2014. You know, so we expect the euro is going to come under immense pressure moving forward. And then there's the yen. I mean, Japan has massive debt. Their debt to GDP is over 200%, and they are continuing to keep rates low, which is going to continue to hurt the yen long term. So, I mean, to answer your question, I'll be adding to my U.S. dollar exposure during the weakness in the dollar. I mean, if the Canadian dollar keeps rising, then it makes sense to move some Canadian capital into the U.S. dollar. And same thing if you're a European. Strong rally in the euro would be an opportunity to move into the U.S. dollar.
The Bank of Canada is set to raise the bank rate on December 7th. What do you think the bank will do?
Well, I mean, the Bank of Canada is similar to the Fed in the U.S. in that they want to have what they call a positive central bank rate. And what they mean by that is they want to see that the central bank rate is higher than the inflation rate. So if we look at the numbers, I mean, the Canadian bank rate right now is 3.75%. Now, the inflation rate is 6.9%. So that says that the real bank rate is negative 3.15%. So if they're going to, you know, try to get through this higher central bank rate, or at least a positive central bank rate, then they're going to need a combination of inflation dropping and the central bank rate rising to a positive real rate. So I would expect that they're going to raise rates on December 7th, but maybe only 50 basis points versus the 75 that they've been doing. So yeah, I think that they've got to keep rising it until they start to see that the inflation rate starts coming down, and so that real rate for them is realized.
What are your thoughts on interest rates near term and long term for Canada and the U.S.?
Well, that requires knowing what the Fed and the Bank of Canada is going to do. You know, I think I've mentioned in the past, these central banks have a real tendency to overdo their policy moves. You know, they kept the rates far too low for far too long. You know, then you added in the COVID lockdowns that crippled the supply chain. Then you add in the war in Ukraine, and we ended up with the highest inflation in 40 years. So now these central banks are really caught between a rock and a hard place. If they keep raising rates, they're going to crush the economy and drive it into a recession.
But on the other hand, they pause it, and inflation is going to keep rising.
So now these rate hikes have a lag effect, and that means that to us that the full impact has not yet been felt. So we discussed both the Bank of Canada and the Fed want to have a positive central bank rate. So short term, I see rates rising, but at a slower pace. I suspect that when we start to see the bank rate gets to 5, maybe 5.5%, that's probably going to be the point that they pause. And then we'd probably see rates start to level off and even eventually decline. But the real key here is, you know, what's the inflation rate doing it?
What will this mean for the bond market?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, when the Fed raises these short-term rates, it affects the short-term yield. So when the Fed raises their rate, it affects the very short-term bond yields much more than the longer term. So the result has been that we got short-term yields now higher than long-term yields. And that's the definition of an inverted yield curve. I mean, logically, that doesn't sound right. I mean, if you're going to lend the government money, you expect to get more return than 3 years, than if you just lend it for 6 months. Now, if we do get a recession, then bonds will do well as investors would start looking to lock in those higher yields as the economy starts to stall out and even decline. You know, and if we do get a recession, like I say, bonds will do better than stocks because stocks do not do well in a recession.
Recession watch, what are you seeing ahead?
Well, again, as noted, you know, the central banks are between a rock and a hard place. They're hoping for a soft landing, meaning that they want to slow inflation, but they don't want to crash the economy and send it into a recession. But while the Fed hopes for a soft landing, there's a lot of indicators out there right now suggesting the recession is definitely coming. I mean, based on just the general definition, you know, two consecutive quarters of negative GDP, well, the U.S. then entered a recession back in the summer. Now, the U.S. Conference Board has its leading economic index, which has had a very accurate record of predicting recessions. They just published their November report. And the headline stated here is the leading economic index fell for an eighth consecutive month. suggesting the economy is possibly in a recession. So there they are. They're suggesting that the U.S. is already in a recession. You know, another very accurate forecaster of recessions, I think we talked about before, is the yield curve. You know, in these rare situations when the long yield is earning less than the short one, the curve is inverted. And Jim, since 1955, there's only been one time where the yield curve was inverted without there being a recession. So, I mean, I would say that the chances of a recession are pretty high.
Martin, where can people follow you and get more information about Trend News?
Yeah, they can just go to our website, thetrendletter.com. So again, three words, all one word, thetrendletter.com. Again, Jim, I post market notes on the site. And so today's notes, I'm going to post a link offering your listeners a Black Friday special offer. So that's for each of our services, and there's some great savings. The combinations ones are fantastic. You can save between 54 and 65%. Also, your listeners can sign up for our free daily headline service. So this is where we review what's happening every morning in the markets, and we send out the headlines that we feel investors should be aware of. Again, it's a free service. You won't get spammed when they sign up for it. We don't do that. You know, it's just it's a nice kind of way to quickly have us scan the markets for you and just give you the headlines, what's going on. And then each headline, there's a link there if you want to read the story about it. And if any listeners have any questions about our services, they can certainly email us at info@thetrendletter.com.
Martin, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
My pleasure, Jim. Take care.
My interview with Martin took place on Friday, November 25th. Coming up, Wolf Richter next on This Week in Money.
Introducing Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Wolf Richter, publisher of wolfstreet.com. He's speaking to us from San Francisco. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thanks for having me back, Jim.
Wolf, what's the latest at wolfstreet.com and how can people sign up?
Well, wolfstreet.com is free. There's no paywall. You can just come and read everything. It's supported by advertisement and by donations. So everything is free, and we have a vibrant comment section, well-behaved mostly, which is also very informative.
Does it look like the Dow could have put in a major bottom?
I don't think so. You know, the Dow is kind of a bizarre animal to begin with. You know, it's an industrial average. It's not a market cap weighted index such as the others that we have. It's 30 big companies and the largest companies in the industries. And so it behaves a little bit differently. It's down 7% from its high. You know, the NASDAQ is down almost 30%. The S&P 500 is down 17%. And we've had a number of bear market rallies here this year, and we continue to get them, and then we end up with lower lows as we go forward. Eventually, the Dow catches up with the S&P 500. Generally, we've seen that over the decades. You know, it just reacts a little differently, and the way it's structured and the kind of companies that are on it. And so I don't see any kind of bottom at the Dow at this point. You know, I think we've had a series of bear market rallies. We've had lower lows after them. And so the trend lower is still there.
What's happening with housing bubbles in Canada and the U.S.?
Well, they're deflating. And they're deflating a little faster in Canada than in the United States. probably started a little quicker in Canada. You know, there's like in Toronto, prices are down 17% or so from the peak overall, and it's like 14%. In the United States, it's a much bigger market. Yeah, so Canada is dominated by these two huge housing markets in around Toronto and Vancouver. In the United States, we've got a lot of different housing markets. But for example, in the San Francisco Bay Area, we're roughly on parallel with Toronto. And so we're down a whole bunch. We're down year over year in the Bay Area. Yeah, so I've been for several months now, the first major housing market in the United States to be down year over year. And so this is a process that that takes a long time, and yeah, there's volatility in it. Mortgage rates have jumped in both countries, and they're different. You know, we have the standard mortgage rate in the United States. It's the 30-year fixed rate. In Canada, you have variable and fixed rates for a shorter term. And so it reacts differently because of the type of mortgages that we have. But the trend is the same, but you know, Canada is leading this one.
Does it look like inflation and interest rates will head higher?
Now, inflation has dished up a lot of surprises over the last 18 months, and I expect that it will continue to do so. And when you look back at the inflation data that we have over the many years and decades, you see that there's a huge variability in it. So whether it's month-to-month inflation rates, you know, they jump up and down dramatically, or whether it's year-over-year inflation rates, you know, they're dependent on two factors. Number one, what this month's inflation rate is, and then also the base rate. The base effects are what the inflation index was a year ago. And so it's dependent on these two factors, and they tend to vary by a large degree. And we've seen that in the 1970s and 1980s, and we've seen it since. And so just because we get a couple of months more inflation is not quite as horrible as it was in prior months, it doesn't mean that that's a trend. You know, that's one of the surprises that inflation dishes out, that you cannot look at a few months and figure that this is a trend. It is too variable. There's too much volatility in the data. And, you know, so I expect for inflation to stay high, whether it will stay as high as it was earlier this year when it was over 9% in the United States. We may not go back to 9%, but, you know, I expect it to stay high, and I expect interest rates to go higher. And the Fed has said that, and the Bank of Canada has said that, and I expect them to stay high longer. And, you know, inflation, we're still not doing anything radical to get inflation under control. You know, if inflation is 8% and the short-term interest rates are 4%, you still have an inflation rate that's way above the short-term interest rate. So that's still actually pouring fuel on the fire. So, you know, when the central banks are not doing anything to really crack down on inflation in a hard way. They're doing the right things and they're going at it slowly. I think relatively slowly. I think that's probably a good idea, you know, and because it's going to take a while anyway. But, I don't see inflation to just go away. Yeah. It doesn't do that. It takes many, many years of much higher interest rates, to get inflation back down, and we have to look at the 1970s and 1980s as a model, and it took a long time there to get and much higher interest rates, you know, to get inflation down.
Any thoughts on how deep the housing price drops could be in the bubble markets of Canada and the U.S.?
Well, that's a hard one. You know, I think the pandemic spike is going to get worked off relatively quickly. And we're seeing that right now. I mean, that's what's being worked off right now is the price spikes of the last year or two. And that's probably not going to take very long. I mean, that's the way prices are falling, you know, that's going to get worked off pretty quickly. And then we'll have to see if inflation stays high and, you know, wages come up a lot, that gives a little bit of support to the housing market. You know, if wages aren't coming up, then that will sort of pull the rug out from under it. And also, you know, if you get an employment crisis, if suddenly we have a lot of unemployed people, that will knock home prices down. In addition, you know, there has been a boom in second homes and third homes and in vacation rentals and in all these things. There's a pent-up supply sitting there that's not showing up on the market. And, I expect that to show up eventually, and we're seeing a little bit of that. This is really hard to tell how low this will go. I at a minimum, I would say the pandemic spike is going to get worked off, and then it might maybe drift lower from there.
When housing bubbles unwind, generally, how long do they take to reach bottom?
Well, in Canada, you know, you really haven't had a housing bust during the Great Recession. It had a little dip there, and your housing bust took place in the 1980s. They take a long time. You know, in the United States, the one during the Great Recession, that took 4 to 5 years to completely unwind from bottom to from top to bottom, and it stayed low for a while. In some markets, you know, it was a rug pull. It went down very fast and stayed low for a couple of years. In other markets, it went down more slowly. Each market had its own dynamics. But it, for most markets, it took 4 to 5 years before you saw any major price increases again.
Is FTX the canary in the coal mine for cryptos?
Well, I think that canary died a long time ago. FTX is the largest casualty so far, and maybe one of the worst examples of what the crypto industry produces in terms of scams and, recklessness and unaccountability and the interconnectedness between all these entities. So what I'm saying, and I started saying this together, they're lending money to each other and they're borrowing from each other and they're using each other's native cryptos as collateral and they use their own cryptos as collateral. And, these things essentially don't have any value. I mean, FTX had its own cryptocurrency, you know, and it collapsed and it was using that as collateral. And, you know, it's just like, just crazy stuff like that is everywhere. And they're all tied together with this. So what I'm saying is they all went to heaven together and now they're all going to heck together, you know, because they're all connected. So there's this contagion going on within the crypto industry and one company's taking out others and crypto hedge funds are taking out crypto exchanges and crypto trading firms are taking down crypto exchanges and it just goes through. And, in terms of the crypto prices, that's a different issue, but a lot of them have collapsed by 90, 95, 100%, practically 100%. You know, the big ones are still hanging in there. I mean, Bitcoin is down a whole bunch, but it's still there, which you can't say about some of the others, you know. And Bitcoin miners are starting to file for bankruptcy in the United States. So this has been going on, you know, and it will continue to go on. There's been a lot of abuse in that industry and regardless of what happens to the major cryptocurrencies, these companies are going to just collapse.
Is credit being constricted?
Well, there is a little bit, of that, but I don't really see it. I mean, the credit applications for credit cards in the United States, for example, have surged, and mortgage credit may get a little bit tougher, but you know, because of the interest rates are higher, so it's more difficult to qualify for mortgage, and so that's an issue. But that's not really a credit constriction; it's just people can't afford the payments anymore. You know, so they don't get a mortgage because they can't afford the payment at the current prices. You know, if prices fall enough, you know, and they towards they can't afford the payment at these high interest rates, they'll get a mortgage. You know, that'll work, but prices haven't fallen enough yet to do that, and this will take a long time. So right now, a lot of the buyers are just not even trying. I mean, mortgage applications in the United States have essentially collapsed. Mortgage applications for purchase a home. You know, refi applications are, they're dead anyway, but applications to purchase a home with, you know, mortgage applications for purchase purposes, they're way down from a year ago. And, you know, they've collapsed much more than the sales volume has, which shows that cash buyers are still buying some. You know, they're not wanting to pay 7% mortgage rate, so they're paying cash for it if they have it. And so those sales are still going on. But the people that need to borrow money, you know, they stopped applying for mortgages, a lot of them. And so, I mean, that's a big factor. It's not really that it's being constricted. It's that high mortgage rates are keeping people away from the market.
With Republicans taking the House of Representatives, is it likely to have any effect on the push for electric vehicles?
Well, you know, I mean, this, we had this crazy legislation passed that threw a whole lot of incentives on electric vehicles for consumers. But what happened is that these are rebates and things like that. And what happened is that automakers instantly raised the prices of their EVs, so Ford, Tesla, etc. And as soon as these incentives came out, you know, the automakers ate them up, essentially, so it passed their gross profit. That's how that goes. And this is really a stupid piece of legislation because EVs are in such high demand. Nobody can build enough of them. There's long waiting lists. You don't need to stimulate something that's already in short supply. I mean, it was just from an economics point of view, it was just an idiotic piece of legislation. And, yeah, there's huge demand for EVs. It's the only thing that's selling. It's the only thing that's growing. You know, the standard combustion engine vehicles, the sales are way down. That's, you know, EVs is what people are clamoring for. And, you know, and the waiting lists are huge, and they are incentivizing this. And so what you will get is higher prices. I mean, this already happened, and we've already seen it. As soon as this was signed, you know, prices jumped already. You know, manufacturers took that rebate. And then there's, you know, state incentives on top of that. So, you know, I don't know that Congress, so that the House can change anything. I mean, the Senate is going to be controlled by Democrats. So, you know, I don't think that law can be repealed. I wish it could, I don't think that's going to happen. And, you know, as far as getting new EV incentives passed, I don't think there's any appetite for that anywhere. I mean, the one that was passed is a huge package. It doesn't have a sunset feature. It just keeps on going until it gets canceled. I mean, it is outrageous what's happening with that. I mean, it's just some idiots did that in Congress, you know, to buy some votes or something. And but it's completely unneeded. And so I don't think anything will change right now. That's we've got a hung Congress, essentially. You know, we've got a Congress where Senate is dominated by one party and the House by the other, so they're not going to get a whole lot of stuff done. I don't think anything will change in that respect with EVs.
Are electric vehicles gaining traction with buyers?
Yeah, I mean, that's the hot thing in the industry. It's shaking up the industry, and I'm happy to see it, you know, because this auto industry was just a bunch of legacy automakers in some sort of oligopolistic structure, and even though there's a lot of innovation going on, but still, you know, and it took Tesla to come along and really shake things up and force their hand. And at first they were blowing him off and blowing EVs off. And then when Tesla decided to build pickup trucks, which is Ford's bailiwick, you know, Ford lives and dies by pickup trucks. Then Ford started getting serious about it. And, so they're, in terms of U.S. manufacturers, ahead of the others. They've got an electric pickup out, and they've got, Mach-E out, and they've got a commercial van out. And so they're still not producing large numbers. Nobody can. The supply chains aren't there. I mean, they have to rebuild the entire supply chain for this. They have to hire engineers. I mean, they have to start all over again. And you know, Tesla is just 10 years ahead of them. And so they're struggling. You know, they cannot build enough of these vehicles. And, you know, they have long waiting lists. And And, you know, GM hasn't, I mean, it has the old Bolt and Bolt EUV, you know, that's years old, but its new stuff is just coming out in very small numbers, and they're talking about 2025 in terms of their mass production. I mean, that's years out, you know, and they've got a long waiting list and everything, too. So, I mean, there's some import makers are starting to make some headway. Kia has some lower priced EVs out now. We're getting startups to show up with their EVs, and that's good. And we're getting a lot of competition from all kinds of sides. And like Polestar is out with an EV that's at the lower end of the price spectrum, and that's good. So, I mean, it's a very dynamic market. Now, there's new players in it that we didn't have before. Eventually, there will be more price competition. Yeah, when the supply chains are in place to where they can actually produce the vehicles that they could sell. And, so it's not a, right now, it's not a demand issue. Right now, it's a supply issue and all the way up. I mean, it's just, not just battery, but, it, you know, EVs have just completely different supply chains on their powertrains. And so that just hasn't been worked out. It takes a long time for these manufacturers to get their supply chains in place. And we're talking years, really. So that will be the constraint going forward.
What's the latest on the new vehicle market?
Well, sales are down, you know, constrained by supply to some extent. So the hottest vehicles now are fuel-efficient vehicles, and they're essentially out. And in terms of inventory, now we're starting to see some buildup of trucks in inventory. And some incentives by manufacturers, and so that's good. New vehicle asking prices are still up, so they haven't come down yet, but I expect they're sky high. You know, I mean, the price spike in new vehicles was just huge, and so the incentives that they're now putting on, I think will eventually start bringing those prices down a little bit, and hopefully we'll get some relief on that, because, I mean, they have, new vehicles have for years priced out average Americans. I mean, they have to buy a used vehicle, and that's why new vehicle sales in the third quarter were back where they were in the 1970s. I mean, it's just really low sales numbers. There's just no growth in the number of units sold, in part because everybody's going upscale, everybody's selling more expensive vehicles, more nicely equipped, and that's where the money is. And they're ignoring the entry level categories of buyers, and so people that lack that kind of income, you know, they're buying used vehicles, and we see that in the new vehicle market. Sales are just dismal. When you think about anything that sells as many units as we did back in the 1970s, and you know, 20% below where we were in the year 2000. I mean, you know, you've got a problem, and of course now we have a supply problem, but yeah, even in 2019, you know, we were back where we were in 2000. So, I mean, it's just an industry that's suffering from having gone upscale too far and having priced out a lot of consumers.
What's the latest on the used vehicle market?
Well, sales are down too. There's plenty of supply. Prices have spiked hugely. I've said for over a year that people should stop buying used vehicles. There needs to be a buyer strike to bring these prices back down. So now they're coming down. People have stopped or have slowed down their purchases. Inventories are looking pretty good. Prices on the wholesale side have come down a whole bunch. On the retail side, they've kind of wobbled along, you know, and it's just now that we see retail asking prices come down enough, where, you know, dealers are seeing that in order to get their volume up, or keep it from deteriorating further, they have to come down with their prices. And interest rates are higher, so it makes it harder to finance these vehicles. I expect used vehicle prices to come down further. They won't go back where they were. I mean, they're up 40%, so that won't unwind that kind of spike, but they'll come down, retail prices will come down, quite a bit, and I don't expect them to go, maybe they'll unwind, if you're lucky, you know, maybe they'll unwind half of those. And, you know, that's on the dealer side, that's a real issue, and we'll see some bankruptcies there, you know, like Carvana and some of the other online dealers. I mean, they already didn't make money in the hottest used vehicle market ever, which was in 2020, 2021. You know, they're losing money back then, losing money hand over fist. Now they've got this inventory that's losing value, and they've got buyers wanting deals, you know, and so they're running out of cash. So I think on the company side, on these startups that got into the online used vehicle business, you know, we're going to see some bankruptcies. The, you know, the old war horses that we have out there, the dealers that have been around for a long time, they know how to deal with this. They've been through this. You know, that they know how to manage that, and they'll be fine, you know, and consumers need to just wait until prices have come down.
What's the latest on credit card debt?
Well, it's interesting in that, you know, we don't really distinguish, we cannot distinguish, we don't have the data on actual interest-bearing debt on credit cards and on credit cards being used to pay for stuff but getting paid off every month. So, you know, when people go on a trip, you know, they buy plane tickets and they make hotel reservations and they buy cruises on their credit cards, but then they pay it off every month, you know, and so they never pay interest on it. They just collect their 1 or 2% bonus points, and it shows up as a balance because they pay off the next month. And so at the month end, you know, this shows up as a balance. And so now we've had this huge surge in travel. And so it's all, it's all paid for by credit cards. You know, you buy anything online, you have to pay for it with your credit card. And so we've had an increase in the credit card balances, and they're really low still, relatively speaking, in terms of overall consumer debt. They're below 9%. That's historically low. In terms of the burden as a percent of disposable income, they're historically low. So credit card debt is really not an issue. And only a small portion of that is actually interest-bearing credit card debt. The rest of it, now credit cards are being used as a payment device. And so hardly anybody pays cash anymore. So we're seeing that those two numbers mixed together, and we can't separate them. So the credit card debt that actually it's interest-bearing is a small portion of that, and the rest is just credit card funds flowing through and getting paid off, and so, you know, it looks very good. I mean, the consumer's flush with money. They still got a lot of this pandemic money. Yeah, they've got huge raises in the last few years. Some of them still have this pandemic money, the PPP loans, as we call them, and those kinds of things, you know, that trillions of dollars were handed out. Some states are flush with money. They're sending money to consumers now, like California and others. We get the inflation checks here, you know, and kind of stupid stuff that they're doing. And so, on the consumer side, credit cards right now are, you know, third-party collections are at historic lows. This is where defaulted credit card debt is sent to for collections. You know, that's at historic lows. And delinquency rates have ticked up from historic lows during the pandemic. So all this looks very strong. I mean, the consumer, the American consumer, has a long ways to go before they're tapped out. And, you know, we need an employment crisis before that happens. Right now, you know, they're flush with money and they're spending it too. I mean, the travel is huge right now and they're running it all through their credit cards and they're paying it off the next month. You know, that's what we're seeing.
Wolf, how can people subscribe to Wolf Street?
Wolfstreet.com. Everything's free. There's a place you can, underneath each article, you can sign up for our email. That's also free. You get, each time we have an article, you get a notice in the email. And, site is supported by donations and ads, so we don't sell anything. It's all there for you to read. Wolfstreet.com.
Wolf, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Wolf Richter, publisher of WolfStreet.com. He was speaking to us from San Francisco. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Martin Strafe, and Wolf Richter. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. Now stand by for a company showcase update from Recyclico CEO Zarko Masalgia. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen. Welcome to Company Showcase, an advertising feature on HowStreet.com.
I'm Jim Goddard. I'm speaking with Zarko Masalgia. He's the Chief Executive Officer of Recyclico Battery Materials. Welcome back to the Company Showcase.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
Boy, you guys have been busy. You've been jetting all over the planet. What's going on?
Yeah, no, you know what? It's been a really exciting time for all of us, and I don't think the office has ever been as busy as we are now. You know, from ongoing travel, conferences, demonstration plant testing, and marketing updates, we're really charging ahead to finish the year off strong, and I just want to share that excitement with our listeners. If you haven't already, I would encourage you to check out our new website and company update video, which is about 3 minutes long, and it shows some great footage of the demonstration plant and the hardworking team involved. You know, we've gotten great feedback on this one, and our marketing and communications team is really working on a lot of other powerful updates, so make sure you're following us. And then in regards to the travel, you know, last week we were at the Benchmark Conference in LA, and that was really energetic, especially on the topic of recycling. Just even, you know, from my own experience, just even experiencing how these conferences have changed. You know, before, the topic of battery recycling at conferences used to just be this kind of lone breakout session that would get some minimal attendance. Now at the Benchmark event, we were on, you know, recycling panel discussions during both the cathodes event and the sustainability event. And it's really signifying just how important recycling is across the whole battery supply chain. And it was especially clear how much of a disconnect there is between battery material supply and the demand needed, just really signaling the urgency for materials, including recycled materials. And then, next week I'll be traveling throughout Europe, where I'll get an opportunity to see some exciting projects and present our recyclical process, really emphasizing the opportunity in integrating recyclical alongside battery manufacturing in order to enable the upcycling of off-spec production scrap and produce those high-value battery-ready materials for new battery production. And as many listeners already know, you know, we've demonstrated this full closed loop with our recycled material already, and we continue to work on this and advance those business discussions, regarding process testing, material validation, and commercial scale-up opportunities. And this is really important, right? Because, we don't really believe that recycling is a competition of building the largest plants or larger plants. You know, it's because at the end of the day, the biggest risk in an industry like this will end up being the material supply. Because those with the waste material, who control the waste material, are the ones that at the end of the day will dictate what happens with that material. And we believe it's more important to build an advanced and efficient recycling technology that provides a positive value for these companies, and can enable and secure a long-term partnership more than, an offtake or taking this material, right? We're looking at the long-term approach, and even when you see the growth of this industry and where it's expected to go in terms of how many gigawatt hours are expected to be produced, you know, this is really only the start in the grand scheme of things. And, you know, just like that one quote goes, you know, be like a duck on the water, calm on the surface, but paddling like the Dickens underneath.
Zarko, so can you tell us where you're traded and how people can get more information from the company?
Yeah, we're traded on the Toronto Venture Exchange under the ticker symbol AMY, on the OTCQB under AMYZF, and the Frankfurt Stock Exchange under ID4. You can find all the information you need at our new website, www.recyclico.com. And you'll find our emails and phone number there if you need to reach us directly.
Zarko, thank you so much for the update.
Thanks, Jim.
My guest has been Zarko Masalgia, Chief Executive Officer of Recyclico Battery Materials. Our interview took place on November 25th. I'm Jim Goddard.
Comments made on Company Showcase are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at HowStreet.com. Company Showcase is a production of How Street Media Incorporated.